Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The main team.
Mega Bears fan.
I don't know if you've noticed, but I did have to change microphones a couple weeks ago because a certain somebody by the name of Liza chewed the cord to my microphone, so it got all staticky when I was trying to use it, and it's like, oh dear. And I see the stream is live. Let's begin.
Welcome to Polycast 434. I'm Makalu. With me, as usual, Canis Albinus.
Don't get sick. It's no fun.
Mega Bears fan?
I generally try not to, but now that I have two children, I feel like it is inevitable.
And the mean team.
In front, behind, and to the sides.
Yes, that is all the directions the germs will get to you. Mm-hmm.
A teenager and a toddler.
Not just the germs.
Ooh.
Oh.
The two hardest at the same time.
Yeah, so I've heard. So
for
I'm experiencing.
Very different reasons.
Yes, one is physically exhausting, the other is emotionally exhausting.
He's got to write the tweet that we're going live.
They're good kids, though.
Yeah, I have a new batch of nephews and nieces, but I noticed that the age count for me is not the same. It might be a little harder at the birthday parties this time around. Well, I'll see what I can do.
Oh, no. How do I find the link? Shoot.
Oh, the link for the live broadcast?
I got it.
Oh.
There's no little children in our family right now. We're pretty much just all old people now.
I might not currently be sick, but I am covered in mosquito bites, and that is a little unpleasant.
I'm grateful that where I live is not near enough to standing water that mosquitoes make it over here.
Yeah, we had so much rain this past winter that, like, mosquitoes are actually a thing here now for a change.
I'm sure they'll be gone soon.
Yeah, usually it's too dry, but not this year. So we actually had to put out a bug zapper out in the backyard and a couple in the house as well.
Hate the smell of bug zappers.
It's an interesting smell, that's for sure.
All right, do we want to talk about the biggest news in the Civ world? We have one news story this week after a month. For some reason, there wasn't a lot of news for Civ. I wonder why. But Alpha Centauri, along with a bunch of other EA games, has been released on Steam. Made a lot of people very happy, myself included.
Uh-huh. The minute they said that thing about Alpha Centauri, it's like, zip, give it to me.
I feel like we were just begging them to do this, like, last time we had a recording. So we must have finally nagged them for the final time.
I doubt that's what caused it, because it was also all the Command & Conquer games.
No, it was us.
Yeah, we take 100% credit for this one. You're welcome, community.
Besides, I know I've said good things about Command & Conquer at some point or another on the show, so that can...
Globally, collectively, everybody complaining about this why-you-know-release finally works.
And as the representation of the global community, you are welcome.
Now they just need a spiritual successor and or sequel.
Do you really trust EA to do that?
No.
Well, maybe the spiritual successor part, because that can be done without EA. Well, the sequel will be more challenging.
Alpha Centauri 2, a games as service live MMORPG with RPG elements and 500 loot boxes, and...
I know what we could do. We could get Ubisoft, Epic, and Blizzard all together to make...
Pre-order now for an extra 100 space bucks for loot boxes.
And EA, of course.
And, of course, 5 different premium currencies.
Oh, and pre-order and retailer-exclusive Civilizations and Leaders.
Yeah, I was about to get that one, yep.
Buy from Amazon to get the Jeff Bezos leader head.
Want to die.
I mean, they had probably... listen, they had Ark and Beyond Earth. That, not quite Bezos, but you know, I could see them doing that.
Yeah, we should probably stop before we actually give them ideas.
To be fair, the lady in Ark was not like evil corporation. It was actually just very big corporation. So I wouldn't say that Ark is any way comparable to Amazon, but...
Well, you don't get to see everything they do in the game, so you don't know. They probably aren't.
If you read the Civilopedia, they are among the least onerous future corporations I've ever read about, so...
I guess that's fair.
because they're not hell-bent on immediate profit.
The question, though, is how much of that Civilopedia is meant to be, like, neutral, objective, like, third-party writing, and how much of it is, like, written by the entities? Because I know for Alpha Centauri, like, all the documentation was, like, in-world, but that wasn't necessarily the case for Beyond Earth.
I think the Beyond Earth Civilopedia was pretty objective.
Yeah, I always got the feeling that it was more like a narrator and less like just propaganda from the various factions.
So what we're saying is you didn't read it off Arkpedia.
Right.
Yeah, which of course was, you know, kind of unfortunate because one of the charms of Beyond Earth was all of the personality that was in that game because of the fact that, you know, so much of the in-game documentation was like written by the characters and entities within the game.
That was Alpha Centauri.
Or sorry, did I say
yeah?
You said it backwards.
All the way around.
I meant that was the charm of Alpha Centauri, as compared to.
You get a pretty good idea by reading everyone's entries. What's going on? It's not. It's not rocket science to put together.
You can say Ark is not Morgan.
Oh, he was. Yeah, like we were saying, they were characters, and Morgan was especially a character.
Now, how well does this actually run on modern systems?
I would assume it runs about as well as anything else from the 90s. So compatibility mode and go to the GOG forums if you can't figure it out, because I'm sure they'll have information about it there.
And is this just a straight port, or like is there any remastering, you know, upscaling kind of stuff going on?
Oh, no, it's just a straight port.
So all the old resolutions and
yep
and stuff, yeah. No fancy ultra widescreen support.
That's... We have to wait even longer to see the effects of the nerf staples and more details.
I'll be honest, I'm glad it's this way because EA would screw it up.
Yeah. Well, I don't trust the current property holders to do it well.
And with a lot of those old games, I mean, there's a tricky balancing act because a lot of the assets and the design of the UI was meant for that particular size of screen at those particular resolutions. And when you do upscaling, sometimes you screw things up, right, and have very unintended side effects.
Yeah, like I think I've seen a wider screen or a 6:9 ratio patch for it before, and that UI sticks in the middle, and then you have these black... The rest of that bottom is black bar to the side, which is kind of disconcerting.
You'd probably have to redo the assets entirely, and while you're at it, like redo the user interface and both input design and how it looks. And
yeah, I've even seen people playing like Civ 5 and Civ 6 on like ultra wide displays, and you know, like in really high resolutions. And even that, I'm kind of like, I don't know if I like this. It just looks like it'd be weird to play. Everything's so far apart.
There are 25 years of fan patches fixing this game, so I'm sure you'll be able to find a way to make it look nice for you.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, though, how many of those are going to be compatible with this on Steam? Because I assume all those were intended for people who were playing, like, the disc or, you know, running ROMs or whatever.
Well, if it's a straight port, you can probably run it from the executable in the way that the mods would.
Yeah, probably, unless, you know, there's something in Steam that prevents some of that stuff from working.
I don't think so.
It's fine. Because the very first thing on the community list for things in Steam is, here's a collection of patches and things you can add to make it better.
There you go.
Cool.
Plus, maybe we talked about all the other resources available earlier this year in the forums on Civ Fanatics, so...
Yeah, wasn't there like a fan remake thing going on?
There's a fan remake, there's tons of other stuff. Which episode did we talk about that on?
It was a few episodes ago, but yeah, an official release on Steam kind of takes the wind out of the sails of a fan remake, unfortunately.
I don't think so. I think that...
Yeah, even if we just get to the point where it's more adaptable, like we're talking about, works better on the modern monitor, and they had other changes they wanted to do, that still it's going to go, because there's still even old, there's games even older than that that have remakes and stuff, and no, that's not going to make them stop.
Oh, I mean, for sure there will still be an interest in that. I mean, there's going to be people who just don't want to buy from EA or from Steam who will, you know, gravitate towards that automatically, but there's, I think that there might be a little bit less interest since people can now get this officially. Unless, of course, EA botched it and it is like a crappy port that doesn't play very well. And if then there might be increased interest.
I'm just going to say this about Alpha Centauri. There will always be a demand for a remaster, because the command or the controls in the original game are not modern by any stretch.
Yeah.
And to people with modern sensibilities, it's cryptic.
Yeah, especially if you don't have the instruction manual sitting on your lap right there in front of you.
Even with it. It's like trying to, it's like going back and trying to play the original Gothic.
These days you can probably find the manual online and put it on the second monitor.
Well, hopefully there's...
probably wasn't the thing when the game dropped.
It's included with it.
Yeah, hopefully in the Steam release there's at the very least like a link to a PDF or something, or hopefully an in-game like PDF that you can open.
I don't think it's in-game, but it's like in the data files, so you don't have to dig for it. It's in the game files.
Works. Yeah. Yeah, I remember a lot the old, you know, 90s PC games having those big like fold-out posters with like all the controls and keyboard shortcuts and stuff.
Tech trees.
Post those on your wall behind your computer so you remember what the heck button does what.
I didn't have that problem. You just push every button until it works. But I was a child then.
Yeah, I wasn't playing a whole lot of games at anywhere near like competitive levels at that point.
So Mackie, have you heard about Reach for the Heavens?
I was going to say, speaking of competitive things, so to speak, this month's new challenge is Reach for the Heavens, where you're going to try and do a culture victory as the Khmer, and it, apparently the scenario was, now is it Built by, or is it, well, Potato McWhiskey, we know he likes stuff, we know he likes Civ, and he was the, either consulted or helped develop, definitely helped develop the scenario, so it's like, whose idea was it? I'm sitting here trying to think, yeah, Khmer for religion, but Khmer for culture. I don't think I tried that.
Yeah, I wonder if the hardest part about this challenge is going to be not accidentally tripping over a religious victory and failing the challenge.
Yeah, it's like, whoops, don't spread it to everybody, but I need to spread it to get the culture.
Religious victory is turned off.
Yeah, that says culture only as the victory option.
Oh, okay. Well, that takes care of that problem then.
So you can also probably just do the tactic of beating everyone down, and then they have to accept your culture because they don't have the means to oppose it.
Yeah. I mean, that's always an option in any of these scenarios. Beat the crap out of the AI and then win whatever the victory condition is. But
yeah. Well, I'm just saying, normally you'd have to be somewhat careful with that because that's another way you can inadvertently win something.
Now, that does lead to an interesting question. If you have the domination victory turned off and you wipe all the other civs off of the map, I mean, you would just automatically win whatever other victory you have, right? You'd have to get to the victory condition, or would you just lose because you did a domination victory instead?
Chances... I don't think it would make you lose on the spot, but I think you could like soft lock yourself into a score victory that way.
I think what happens is, depending on the victory condition, you either automatically win or you soft lock. Because I think if it's a science victory, you still have to complete the science victory. If it's the military victory, you automatically win. If it's the culture victory, you're probably already automatically winning before you finish taking the last capital anyway.
Yeah.
You could probably engineer it so that's not true, though.
Well,
and
sure.
And then soft lock yourself.
We're also assuming that the culture victory isn't just like, oh, there's nobody left, you win.
That's true. I don't know if that's what it does or not.
I don't know how that works. Like, yeah, because, I mean, you're the only civ at that point generating tourism, so... You have all the tourism.
Well, as you're conquering the other people, your tourism is going to overwhelm their culture.
Yeah, so like we said, you'd probably trip over that
condition
on the way there. And then there's also the religious victory. I would assume if you're the only civ left and you founded a religion, you win the religious victory, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you automatically become...
Interesting, though. Because if it works where you're just automatically assumed the culture winner, if there's no other victory conditions active, then it really would be fastest, most likely, to kill everybody as fast as you possibly can. because then it would award you a victory. Whereas, like, spreading your culture takes time, and spreading your military units takes less time than that usually. So, like, that's actually relevant to if you're, like, trying to get the challenge done as quickly as possible.
Probably.
But, like, if you're going to soft block yourself, then it's probably not a good idea.
Yeah, people in the forums are still discontent about that you can't play higher than Emperor. Some people want to do it on Deity and stuff like that. And also that it's a random map again and not a fixed map. But it's not, I guess they're not really trying for the Game of the Month vibe type of thing, even though it is a Challenge of the Month, but,
well,
you know, not so strict.
Game of the Month didn't do fixed maps. I think fixed maps are cool, though. That's why we did those things in Sephora. Is that, like, you players can actually compare notes on how they progress through the game that makes that stuff more. And that wasn't a challenge format, but so.
I
don't see any reason to prevent people from playing on higher difficulties if they want to. Like, there's nothing about Prince or Emperor that's going to make it harder to win than Immortal or Deity. I feel like anybody who can beat it on Deity has completed the challenge. Come on.
The believed reason is because they would have to make extra art.
God.
Extra.
For the badges just, like, for winning?
They could just use, like, assets from the game if that's such a problem. Come on now.
Yeah, some people getting too excited over the number 7. Does that mean it's a 7 challenge? Is it 7? 7-7? Guys, calm down. It'll come. I understand being hyped, but come on.
That's not technically guaranteed. It's just highly probable.
There are a lot of things shaping up to be coming out at this year's Summer Game Fest, so I've heard the rumor that it's going to be June 7th. Is going to be the announcement date or something. I don't know.
If mobile game gets announced, do you guys not have...
That's, yeah. They said they were developing the other thing. That's what it'll be. And like, but it's the wrong thing.
They already announced the Civ mobile game, though.
And now I get the sequel.
They technically did that, too. Because there was that one Civ mobile game that was in Korea a bunch of years ago.
Oh, I remember us covering that now that you mentioned it. I don't know. I don't know if that really counts.
It never left Korea, so I don't think so.
Yeah, and there was some discussion and also in the thread about using the Naturalists and Rock Bands later in the game to help speed it up, you know, which is a couple of things I didn't know, but which one is it? Well, one of them will decrease their stack of the stack of their domestic tourists, so that helps you get closer faster because you have to overwhelm them with the culture. But, you know, at least the other thing about this, with this being the May challenge, a lot of people will talk about the cultural victory more because that's still one that for everybody, I think most everybody, for Civ 6 is kind of like, how I do?
Yeah, maybe we'll finally figure out how the heck it works.
Okay, moving on to a different topic entirely, one that's, of course, dear to my heart here. Speed of Civ 4, 5, 6, ? 7? An ascending trend, ? This is by Lazy Sweeper, and basically the opening post is talking about the speeds of the Civ, mostly the tween turn time, though I in my player's turn time is also relevant, but this is mostly about between turn time and how Civ 4 is by far the fastest of the three newest games in that regard. The one thing I don't agree with here is the quote-unquote trend aspect. Like, 6 is faster than 5, and like there's not enough data points to get a trend with any confidence. So I don't know. It's a little weird to like frame it as a trend, but certainly the games after 4 have gotten very noticeably worse with how long it takes the game to execute turn, player hits end turn, to the point where that's a non-trivial gate to like completing a game. It affects the user experience. How much depends on the user and how much they care, but to an extent, everybody who says the game feels slow in the late game is feeling some effects of this, because they're spending, you know, minutes per turn not playing. If you're playing turns relatively quickly, that's a pretty significant fraction of your playtime. I made a post in the thread, and I got one disingenuous response to it. Other than that, haven't engaged too much in the thread directly.
Yeah, in previous Civs, like, I was content to play it on, like, normal speed or even attempt marathon-style games, but in at least with 6, I have to have it at least on quick, because everything feels like it takes so long. You know, it takes like this many turns to build a warrior, this many turns for a settler. Why does it take that long? I mean, maybe it's because I played too much of the multiplayer and I'm used to it being a bit faster, but at the same time, even with that higher speed, when you get to the end game, it just slows to an absolute crawl.
Now it's that, like, you mention it, I haven't looked at build times versus like production cost between the game. Like, how much production is realistic to expect in a typical city, and how much do units cost per era in that city in the various games? Because that's also going to be a factor there, in addition to turn time.
Well, unit costs, I think, are 2 to 3 times what they were in Civ 4, because remember, Civ 4, you were building large stacks, and in Civ 5 and Civ 6, you're supposed to be building smaller armies. So, but that's a difference in design that isn't necessarily just a scaling.
Well, sure, but all of these things play a role in end-user experience. And, I mean, in principle, you probably want fewer units than you wanted in Civ 4. Like, you could easily manage, like, 100 to 150 units in Civ 4. That sounds like an absolute nightmare, even in Civ 6.
Well,
which relieves the stacking thing a little bit.
Also, remember going back to vanilla Civ 5, how painfully slow that was at release. Because, like, build times were ridiculously slow. There was very little production in the game. You know, they had to patch in a bunch of new sources of production just to make it so that you could, like, finish a unit within an era.
Yeah, it was pretty much time.
Like, you know, building a unit would take, like, 15 turns or more. It was like building a wonder.
Yeah, and in 6, it scales with the game speed, but it's strange that normal still feels too slow, even with all the production things we got. I know there's some things like you play Mali, and of course you don't have the production because you're supposed to rely on Gull, but yeah, it's just still too, it's still too long, too much somehow at normal.
Yeah, I still, like, a big part of this is that one more turn is 5 minutes and not less than 1 minute. That makes a big difference.
At the beginning of the game, it can be less than 1 minute, but later on, absolutely. It just, there's so many things, and there's so much management. Like, if you're trying to do, on Conquering, you're going to have a lot more units to move and stuff. But even in a normal, peaceful game, there's so much of moving things around and everything that takes like 5 minutes, and that should not. Some of it's just waiting for the game to flip to the next unit.
Yeah, and that takes way longer than it should. And if you try to outspeed the game, you get, at least the last time I played, inconsistent input buffering, which is the worst kind.
And also just like the extra tedious overhead of having to move units one at a time instead of in large stacks.
Yeah. Well, there too, if you could do it fast enough, it wouldn't be a problem. You can make controls that, and it's never going to be as fast to move 100 units separately as together. But if you're trying to move like 20 units separately and you can give them all orders in less than half a second each, that's not that big of a turn, time burn. And like a lot of your choices with those units are meaningful too. So like if you can actually give your 20 unit army orders in less than a minute, if you have the cognitive ability and practice to do that, then it's probably not too bad. The problem is that ever since one unit per tile has been implemented, they've never designed the game in a way where that's possible.
Well, and on top of that, you have the exacerbating circumstance of it's hard even just to queue up a multi-turn movement, because a lot of times if anything happens that obstructs that unit's movement, like they go into the fog of war and uncover rough terrain, or there's another unit blocking the path that they're supposed to take, like sometimes they'll just flat out turn around and start going the other direction.
Yeah, since that was implemented in Civ 5, I argued so strongly against it. It's such an awful choice from a UI design perspective. Like, it just doing the very simple thing that even games in the 90s knew how to do of interrupting the unit's orders and making it, like, making it on your queue for things to give orders to again is better than that. And it's better than by a lot.
Yeah, so, like, you feel like you have to move all of your units one turn at a time, because if you don't, then they're not going to go where you want them to go.
Yeah, and not being able to trust the game is awful.
Yeah, that is immensely frustrating, and that also slows down the pace of the game tremendously.
I've never had that problem, but I've also never had a 20-unit army.
I've had more than 20. Some of the CD multi-front wars.
And then, of course, another exacerbating factor on a personal level is, you know, I'm not a 20-year-old college kid anymore like I was when I was playing Civ 4. I don't have as much free time as I used to. I have a lot more pressures on my time. So increasing turn times are, you know, not only are they longer, but it's also felt more acutely because I don't have hours and hours and hours, you know, to stay up till 2 or 4 in the morning and play the game like I used to.
Yeah, if you've only got that 2 or 3 hours maybe in the evening and you can only get through, what, 20 or 30 turns in that time, and that's silly.
Yep.
Maybe it's just because I have a really nice computer, but I don't really have a problem with in-between turn times. Like, even in the late game, it's not that bad for me.
Well, it'll depend.
Bad, it's not that bad. Like, what have you timed it?
5 seconds.
Oh, that is nice.
Well, I mean, do you have all, like, the animations and stuff turned off and things like that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's part of it. Also, if you're not playing on... If you're playing on, like, larger maps and stuff like that, then, of course, you're going to have a lot more, too.
Yeah, on the larger maps, I have longer load-in times than I do anything else. That's the big problem with those maps. But even if I'm on a large map, it doesn't take long to turn over the turn.
That's good, then.
Yeah, and I think it does run better if you're on an SSD and such.
Yeah.
But a lot of people who are playing are still working with computers that are from when Civ 6 first came out or only maybe halfway through the dev cycle. So.
Yeah, I had an old computer that I was playing Civ 6 on for a long time, an old gaming laptop, and it would take like 10 minutes just to like 10, 15 minutes maybe just to load into a game.
Loading it isn't as bad because like you do it once per session. Now, 15 minutes is a long time.
But
that's
again,
a long time. But
when that's when that's like an eighth of the playtime you have available to you, it's significant.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not great then.
And that was like it's after all long. The
but, like,
yeah, like
that's the one time I'd expect like some delay.
Sure, yeah. And than, this, like, this also was like after all the expansions because like each expansion also made that take like another couple minutes. So
there's a reason why the default is now a small map instead of a standard map.
Yeah. And now I do have, you know, a nicer computer with an SSD and loading into the game is so much faster.
Can you actually turn off animation now?
You can speed them up.
I wish you could turn them off outright.
Aren't there also options to like not show like AI movements and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, because the thing is, I leave that stuff on because even though it is tedious and slow, I do want to see what the AIs are doing. And unfortunately, you know, the game, there's no way to set up the game so that it only shows you AI moves that, you know, might be interesting to you. You have to see all of them or none of them. Like, there's no in between. Like, it would be nice if the game were smart enough to know that, hey, this is an AI move that you might want to know about and show you that one and then skip all of, like, the city-state units just running around in circles every turn. In fact, it would be nice if they had separate settings for the other factions versus city-states and barbarian movements. That might help a lot because then you could leave Civ AI movements on and turn off, like, city-state, show me city-state movements or show me barbarian movements.
I think those are a big ask for people who can't do pathing properly.
Sure.
It's not that hard as a programmer.
Like,
it's not that hard
you
at
can,
all.
You can, well, the hard part is evaluating what is most likely to be interesting to the player.
Oh, yeah. Like what you would do.
The factions versus city states. Okay, that's pretty simple.
What you would do
out
is.
The faction versus the city state.
You'd
what's
basically.
Interesting to the player, not so much, in my opinion.
Basically, what you would do is you would say, am I at war with this country? Okay, I'll look at their movements. If not, okay, no.
That would be one way to do it.
That's simplistic, but yeah, that would work. Yeah, I mean, that's better than nothing, for sure.
Or at least, if not at war, then, you know, not friendly.
Or, yeah, I was going
like,
to say, because
you
might want...
The more the harder this gets. And yeah.
Sure, yeah.
In worst case, you can always just toggle this on and off, even current.
I mean, there could also be settings for, like, only show, like, neighbors' moves, you know? So only civs that are, like... You know, within a certain proximity. I mean, that's a little bit more challenging, but there's things
then,
like that. You
then,
can
like,
do.
Someone forward settles you on an island, and now you see all their moves. Like,
possibly.
I like
yeah.
Canis's suggestion of the war, because like that's when you're most likely to care about units.
Probably.
But there's also edge cases where, like, you know, are you then going to see that civ mobilizing a bunch of units, you know, towards you in preparation for declaring a war, and that's
you
something
check.
You might want to see too.
You should.
So.
You can check.
I was gonna say.
Kind of
don't want to have the game do all the work for us, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the other option would be just give you a list of all the factions and say, I want to watch these guys' moves, make it toggleable.
I mean, if you're really attentive, you can probably notice stuff like that on a mini-map. Like, if you have your scouts deployed in a way where you'll see units passing and, like, there's more of that color on the minimap than there was like last turn or yeah, 2 turns ago or whatever.
I mean, that could be another way of handling this is having like more robust minimap options. Like maybe have like an expandable minimap that can have toggles for showing unit positions and stuff like that. Another thing that could be helpful is if there were like maybe a way during the turn to like see what movements happened, like some kind of overlay or something that shows the path that units have taken in the previous turns so that you don't have to necessarily watch their moves happen between turns, but during your turn, when you're looking around the map, you can see where all the movements have happened. Does that make sense?
I think that's unnecessary.
Hard to implement alongside the fog of war. Right? Like, again, some of these things are relatively trivial to implement. Others would be not so trivial.
See, that one to me sounds like it's unnecessary because you just look at the map and you can see where the unit is. It doesn't matter necessarily where it came from.
Well, it might if you're like trying to predict AI stuff or human stuff, but I don't think the value of it is merits the.
Well, it there's also
it wouldn't
other
work
edge cases.
In a multiplayer game.
Yeah, there's also other edge cases, like say an AI unit moved into the fog of war, right? And now it's your turn and you can't see that unit at all. And if you skipped unit movements, you didn't see that there was a unit there ever. So if there was some way to see that, yes, there was a unit there last turn that is now in the fog of war and is invisible, that could be valuable.
Now, wait a minute. You could definitely have seen that there was a unit there the previous turn.
No, I mean, if you didn't know there was a unit there and you didn't see the AI move, or even if an AI unit moved from the fog of war out into your field of vision and then back into the fog of war, you know, like it's like a cavalry unit that's got like 4 or 5 movement, that can also happen. And you don't see that at all.
That doesn't happen in Civ 6 because the rough terrain will stop it.
That is a good point, though. Should that be visible? I don't know.
I don't think it matters, personally.
It for the most part, it would.
It's a situational
thing. There'd be edge cases where you might care about
them. And I bring this up because I have specifically had this happen where I wasn't paying attention between turns or, you know, whatever, and I did not see unit movements, and I didn't know there were units there. And, you know, that has bit me in the butt every now and then. So this is things that are coming from experience. This isn't me just pulling, you know, hypotheticals out of my butt here. These are things that have happened to me in games.
Scouts.
Yes. I don't know. Like, even on Deity, like, if you play with the assumption that there might be crap in the fog view, like, all the time, reasonable, because they tend to have some stuff at first.
Sure.
Then, like, you might care now and then, but it's so niche compared to, like, so many things that would be helpful on a turn-to-turn basis to, like, either play the turns yourself faster or to have the turns advance faster and stuff. Like, I think, given how bad it is right now, that's really where whoever's in charge of the UI in Civ 7 needs this, is like, let us play through our turns quickly, at least make it possible for us to do so if we want to, and then like, don't make it take ages in between turns. If we're really getting 5 seconds between turns like Canis, that's pretty good in the late game. Like, if we're actually at that point, okay. It's probably harder to optimize past that if we're getting that good. But then like, at least make our turns also have good user interface stuff. And then we can worry about like the niche, like, nice to have. But right now, we're not even at the point where, like, we have things that we should have.
Agreed. There are a lot of avenues for improvement, and the stuff I was talking about are not the highest priority.
But yeah, like, some things, like you mentioned, I didn't think about, but that would, like, with the minimap, and, like, you hit a button to, like, zoom the minimap in and out or toggle on information on and off on the minimap. Like, Paradox games have some degree of that going on. And it's useful to have, like, you just like hit a button or hotkey, or you click a button on the mini map and like it changes your view quickly. Like, you get a bunch more information at a glance that, you know, you can play with it on all the time, or if it's too noisy, you can toggle it on and off as you want it. And like, stuff like that makes a big difference in player experience.
Yeah,
without really needing to do any like algorithmic decisions for the AI, or, you know, decide how this should work or how the presentation should look all the time. Like, just having options like that, big.
Yeah, and I mean, you could have, you know, toggles like things like heat maps of unit activity or battles and stuff like that that could be useful, that would let you then go and look at what the heck on the actual map happened. Yeah, there's things that could be done with the mini map that would make a lot of things in the game more readable.
If you're going to have one, you might as well.
And there's already multiple lenses on the mini-map, so it's not like this is something that's, like, impossible from a technical standpoint.
Well, they have multiple lenses on the general overlay, too. Yeah, just unit control and pathing would be my maybe my top ones to fix for Civ 7. And yeah, I will say fix.
And those bad. Actually affect how the game plays. Like those are also gameplay issues too, right? Because you don't want your unit just turning around and going the wrong way without like you telling it to.
Yeah.
Like that's affecting your strategy and your tactics.
And I hate like clicking to move a unit in multiplayer. And then like I wait to see if it happens. Because I'm also trying to order like three or four other units back to back to certain spots. And my ability to do that is contingent that like I have to wait and visually confirm that the thing did what I ordered. Because otherwise the unit is in the way of the next unit and it will like screw up the pathing of the next unit because it can't take that path. It's awful. Like, I really hate the inconsistent input buffering. That one's miserable. And with the connection issues. You're gonna have some latent fun, whatever, but they gotta do input buffering better than doing it.
So guys, what's your favorite policy card?
Science funding! By which I mean the first one is the 100% adjacency bonuses for the campuses.
Is that rationalism?
Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
And it gives you bonus every time for more than 10 civs and more than 10 pop and more than 15 pop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it has there's an early game the early game version that just gives you a flat 100% adjacency bonuses too, because between the two of them, you really skyrocket the science if you've been building campuses and stuff.
Yeah, and those early ones, like that's where adjacency is really nice, because like unlike the other ones, you get those early, like Mackie says. Now, that's not my favorite. Those are very good, but they're not my favorite. My favorite, personally, is ones that let you more tiles per turn.
Let you what? More tiles per turn?
They let you can move your military unit further. Some of them are conditional, some of them are not, but all of them are really nice.
So, like, blitz and stuff like that?
Yeah. Or even the one that's, like, if you start in friendly territory, start move. Well, oh, when you capture a city, that's now your culture.
Friendly territory.
Friendly territory. So like you can consistently have 4 to 5 move like infantry units in the mid to late game. And that's really helpful.
So
that changes how I fight wars. And the sooner I get that going, like the nicer the wars feel.
Yeah, especially considering how tedious it is to, you know, move units one turn at a time like we were just talking about.
Well sure, but now you like your military is straight up stronger because it lets you do things you otherwise couldn't do. In terms of like attacking enemy units, catching things out, finding things and then moving stuff in position to shoot them, or even just like closing on cities, like the rate at which you take cities increases a lot because you're basically more than double, you're either double or more than double the speed. So like now you can take a city and it'll like flip in like 3 to 4 turns. Well, you don't care because you're going to take the next 2 cities in 2 to 3 turns. So now there's pressure on the first one before it flips. Like, this stuff makes a big difference in your progress.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say that these are my favorite, but I think the ones that I run the most are probably the early game cards. There's the economy card that just gives you +1 production in every city. And I feel like I run that for like half the game, every game I play. And then conscription, which just reduces unit maintenance costs. Like, I feel like those are just the ones that I always have slotted for like until they become obsolete.
Yeah. Yeah, if we're talking like, I would answer differently if we're talking like what's giving you the most value across a game versus just like what I like having.
Yeah.
Because some of those things are like workhorses, but they're not like that exciting. Like, this is obviously useful. I'm going to take it every game, but like, I don't get that like feel of joy when I added this. I'm like, oh yeah, this is nice to have. I'm a little stronger now.
Feeling of joy would be like you're Phoenicia. You build 5 cities on your home continent and then 1 city on a foreign continent. Then move your capital to the foreign continent and use the colonial taxes and colonial offices cards.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah. Like, I'm not going to knock the value cards, though, because they're good. Like, I use them, too. It's just not the same. They don't make favorite, even though they're good.
I like the one that Merchant Confederation, which is just free gold for having an envoy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because you can stack that, especially if you're envoy heavy, so much cash. Even in a more, even a not so envoy heavy game, and I use it a lot in multiplayer as well because I usually have envoys over the place, and that little bit per envoy stacks up, especially when there's a lot of city states involved. And I end up taking because I do Classical Republic. I'm getting terms wrong today. But there's the policy card that comes from that you can slot in as the in the wild card slot later that gives you, I am completely blanking, but it's bonuses to amenities and stuff.
New deal?
No, that's late game. This is early game.
Early game.
Let's go classical Republican Legacy, I think.
There we go.
Yeah, because that really, because especially in that middle part, because it's still early and you're still expanding, and sometimes the cities can grow quickly, and that way you get the extra housing and the extra amenity in there, so you have a little extra time to build up the city.
What is it? Raj is also really good if you've got barbarian settlement, barbarian lands on, because you get a lot more city-states and a lot of them don't get met.
Yes.
They're like, here, have three envoys and nobody will ever see you again. I know Phil likes the ones that are just unit maintenance minus one, unit maintenance minus two.
Those are certainly nice.
Also, war weariness minus 50%, minus 25%.
That's more situational for me. Like, depends on how far I am in the game and how much war weariness is really impacting me. Because, like, once you start rolling, you're not fighting particular civs for that long. Because, like, you crush their army, then you take their cities within, like, 5 turns to 10 turns after that. And then, like, that war's over. So, like, the war weariness is not... it's not as crucial as, like, being able to move quickly.
Conclusion, in a sense, moving I'm bad quickly at war.
Saves more war weariness. And it's the same thing with maintenance. Like, I do like maintenance stuff, but if I have other things that make more money than the maintenance, then I'll just take making more money instead. So, you know, those are not... they're not as favorite for me, and they're not necessarily as strong either when it comes to just, like, militarily beating stuff down. Now, don't get me wrong, I take them sometimes, but they're not as powerful.
I think if I were picking favorite policy cards and not just the most functional policy cards, I think it would come down to basically two. It would be the policy cards that speed up the production of wonders and the policy card that, like, speeds up the production of settlers. Because when I'm running those, that means I'm about to either build a wonder, which is always really nice, or settle a new city, which is always fun. So those are the ones that I think I get the most excited about running, because it means I'm about to get really good new stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine, the 50% less on settlers and then 30% on builders. Watch me expand everywhere. All that land, that's mine, that's mine, that's also mine. That over there is mine.
Especially when I'm playing those in a situation where I actually am racing, like, another player or a civ, like, to a wonder or to a place to build a city, because then those are the policy cards that actually get me, like, you know, salivating.
It really does come down to those noticeable, tangible benefits, doesn't it? Because even in my case, like, I like the unit movement speed because of what it's getting me and how much faster it's getting me that. It's kind of similar to you can build the settler much faster.
Yeah, and this comes down to
a very similar energy.
Yeah, and this comes down to a difference in play style. I'm a builder and you're a fighter, so, but it's, they're like the equivalents of each other.
Yeah, although you have to build the fight. So, like, I use the building aspect of the game too, because, like, it matters. Like, you need to make units to fight wars, and those units need to at least be competitive with your enemy. So you can't neglect your empire's economy as a fighter. You can somewhat, but only to a degree. If you do it too much, then you're just, like, out-teched and then just wrecks you.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's, you know, just the fun situational policy cards where, like, you have, like, a really crazy good adjacency bonus or whatever and some civ ability, and then you combine that with, like, a policy card that doubles your adjacency bonus. Now you've got, like, a plus 14 production industrial hub or something like that. You know, that's always fun, for sure.
Yeah, niche interactions that are, like, specific to civs, and then they, because of the interactions, they're really good. As Dan would like to say, the synergy is really strong. Right. Those can be satisfying too.
I don't think I Dan likes that word.
He likes that word.
Maybe.
He sure likes to use it.
He's not here to say otherwise. Get wrecked, Dan.
He loves to use it and then tell us how much he hates using it.
Yeah.
Now that I believe.
And I understand his, as someone who worked for a large corporation that, you know, went through multiple quote synergies during my time there, I understand.
Yeah.
Dan's complaint.
Yeah, I do as well. But it just made me think of him. But, like, I won't call this favorite just because you do need to be running specific civs to to make use of that, and I don't like just meaning one civ all the time. So
we're at least using the word
favorites for me.
Yeah, we're at least using the word correctly and not in corporate Orwellian doublespeak.
That's true too.
Hey, now be careful. I am a CEO after all.
Yeah, well, yes, we haven't heard you abusing the word synergy, so you're not a fallen CEO.
I like the term fallen CEO.
Your incentives are still aligned.
And before everybody in the comments and whatever starts jumping on my back for being a fat cat CEO, I have no employees, so not ripping anybody off.
You're not the CEO of a multinational, multi-billion-dollar company that's on Tuesday reporting record profits to shareholders and then on Wednesday laying off 5,000 people and closing down game studios.
Right.
Yeah. Candace is like a cool CEO, man.
No. I'm just... Tough, man.
Like,
I'm just...
Like, if you want to do right by people and you're working at a company like that and you're at levels of management where... Now you have to start making choices between doing right by people versus, like, keeping your own position. That's gotta suck.
In the amount of experience I have with being a CEO, there's a lot of really hard choices. And I'll just say that. You have to do things you don't want to do, and there's not really anything you can do about it, so... Should we talk about things we want back from older civs? This topic that we've had on the list for like 5 months that is finally coming up.
I would be okay with talking about that, sure. Let me just find that topic. So back in August of last year, the user, Pokeel?
Yep.
Posted on Civ Fanatics forums, little things from prior games that I hope are in Civ 7. And I'm pretty sure I actually responded on this thread, but it's been so long now, I forgot. But anyway, so I'll talk about the OP first and then my own ideas. So Pokeel wants jerseys to come back for Civ 7, which is, you know, where you can like pick different colors for the Civs. They want unique palace graphics from Civ 6. Which I assume is just the palace, the 3D model of the palace on the world map, not like the old Civ 3, like a build your own palace thing, although that would be kind of neat to have back, especially if it is a 3D model in the game space. That could be fun. Named geographic features. Yeah, I think that's going to be a feature in like every 4X game moving forward. I mean, the other games that we've seen coming out all have that too. I don't think that's going anywhere. Named continents, same thing. Easy mod setup for multiplayer games. Yes, multiplayer support is good. Have robust multiplayer support and let multiplayer players play mods. Peace and war themes from Civ 5. That one, that's the only one where I'm a little bit iffy because I really like Civ 6's soundtrack and I really like how they have, how every Civ has a unique theme and that theme... like changes over the course of the game, and like every they already have what is it like 4 different musical
yep.
pieces for every Civ in the game, and there's like 50-60 Civs in the game. Maybe not quite that many because there's multiple leaders.
There's,
and leaders
yeah,
and
there's
stuff 50 like that,
60 leaders, not Civs.
Yeah, this is like 40-ish Civs, I think, or 30-ish somewhere in there. But that's still like I mean we're talking about hundreds of pieces of music. And now if you want separate ones for, I mean, I guess you could just have like a war theme. Of course, that would be the only music that Phil would ever hear the entire game. And then he wouldn't get to
everyone all at once.
I don't know. But then, I mean, it's like, oh gosh, like, are you going to have separate war themes for every Civ in the game? Like now you're talking about potentially doubling that music. Like that's expensive.
Well,
so,
there's also ambient music for various areas of the world. And you could make stuff like that with a war theme. But there's more music in Civ 6 than just the leader, just the civilization
true.
Soundtracks.
True. There's... So I'm not saying don't do this. I'm just saying, like, I like the way that Civ 6's soundtrack was handled. And I would prefer to see that than to see, like, Civ 5, where there's just a peacetime theme and a wartime theme. Personally, that's me.
That's fine.
And yeah, if they're going to have the different music for every Civ and then also have like a war theme, like, sure, that's fine. That's doable. I don't mind that. What do we got? Different graphics for terrain on different continents. Again, I think that's going to be a mainstay for these sorts of games moving forward. I mean, he says Civ 5, but Civ 6 did that too, right?
Civ 5 did it first.
Yeah. Atolls and reefs. Yes, more water geography. More things that makes water not just a solid chunk of nothingness.
7.8 out of 10, too much water.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, also just things to make, you know, naval play more interesting. Like, have defensive, you know, bonuses in water. You know, have things to explore in the water. You know, it'd be nice to see, like, you know, abysses and trenches out in the middle of the ocean that you can send, like, submarines or something to explore and get some science from them or their natural wonders or something. Like, just more things to do in the water, I think, is generally good. And well, more resources and stuff like that.
We probably don't need a bunch of modern stuff that nobody before 1950 could really interact with, but there's plenty of stuff in the ocean that, and then the waters of the world in general, that is not locked behind modern technology that could still be added to the maps.
Sure, yeah. And then the last thing that the OP posts is the We Love the King Day from Civ 5. Okay, yeah.
It's like the most inconsequential thing.
Now, personally, me, the little, and I've been on this soapbox for years, the thing that I want to see back is hidden nationality on privateer units from Civ 4 and Civ 4 Colonization, where other players' privateers look like barbarians to the other players, and you don't know who owns the ship unless you sink it.
So you don't find out who owns the ship when you sink it either. You only find out by finding who popped the Great Admiral.
Well, sinking a privateer should at least have a chance of revealing who commissioned the ship. But yeah, oh, that would be my thing, because I think personally, I think one of the reasons that naval play is so stagnant is that, you know, one of the reasons that our large intercontinental empires, you know, the British Empire, the Dutch, you know, the Spanish, the reason they had large navies was because they were protecting their shipping from, you know, pirates and from, you know, also from privateers that were commissioned from other rival countries. And in Civ 6, like, unless you're at a state of war, you don't have to worry about, like, your trade units getting sunk out in the middle of the ocean. I mean, maybe a barbarian caravel shows up every now and then and sinks one, but it's not like a pervasive threat like the way it has been. So you don't have to build a large navy to protect your shipping. And I think if you did, if there was a risk that even during peacetime, the other players might be doing some piracy, you're going to be building a navy and you're going to be using that navy.
I want to be able to claim resources without having to build cities in the tundra.
Yeah, so the colony, some kind of colony mechanic like from Civ 3?
Yes.
Yeah. I know in Civ 4 and Civ 5, forts claimed underlying resources. Do they not do that in Civ 6 anymore?
But they have to be in your territory. The colony is outside your territory.
Yeah, they have to be in culture for that door.
Oh, you can't build forts in neutral territory anymore?
Can, but you don't get the bonus from it. For.
Okay, yeah.
So you don't get the resource. You get the defensive bonuses, but you don't get the resource stuff.
Mackie, Phil, any suggestions from you?
I want Civ 4 UI controls and then improve them.
Phil's answer is just, I want UI improvement.
Yeah, it's such a big deal that it's going to dominate my list.
Demographics, top 5 cities in the world.
You know, all that stuff is secondary. I just want the controls to be good first. Don't get me wrong, all that stuff would be nice to have too, but at the end of the day, I'd like to be able to like implement the choices I make in the game without having a significant amount of time to.
I think I wish at least a couple of mods I play with that are integrated in. Like, there's one that shows on the policy cards, if I switch to this policy, what am I going to get out of this? How much gold, how much culture, whatever that is. That makes my decision making a lot more informed. That's a little bit of information. I can't flip out of the policy screen to go look this up. I can't keep all the... I can't sit here and math all the yields that would be off my empire. Which also, the Empire reports could be a little more organized. I think that mod also gives me better
with the
reports.
Policy cards. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, the policy cards.
Because the bigger you are, the more like mathing that would be, and like trying to legitimately math it all out in advance before you put the card in without that information presented to you can be like just an awful time sinking. Actually, try that. So yes, but having something like a mod like that put into the, I mean that is a straight up major UI improvement. That's an example. It's not an input efficiency thing, but it's still, well, it kind of is, but major time sinking.
Yeah, and along the lines of, I think you had mentioned, like, more Empire overview sort of things. Like, another thing that I missed from Civ 4, and I think it was also in older games, was the web of diplomatic relationships. There was that screen where it showed all the leaders, and then, like, the green and red lines and blue lines and stuff like that, connecting, like, who was at peace with who and who had treaties with who and who was at war with who.
Yes.
That would be a very nice thing to have back, so they don't have to click through every single leader and be like, hey... do you like this other civ? You want to go to war? Like a way to just see like who would be a, you know, a good person to go to first for like some kind of diplomatic deal.
Yeah, because those things are within the actual diplomacy screen because you can see the different icons on the other leaders, but having it laid out in a more graphical, easier to understand format would be great.
Yeah, there's no one screen that shows all of them. Like you have to look at every single leader to see who they're. Yeah.
So many useful things I've forgotten. Like I'm pretty sure you can navigate to an individual leader from that web by right clicking on the leader head.
You could.
So,
and then
like that's another thing. Like this just saves time compared to like having to click back out and then click on the leader and then do it. Like,
you know, think about that. That feels more intuitive to do that, to have that overview screen and just, oh, that guy hates that guy, let me go to him, click, you know.
Another little thing from Civ 4 that I really liked that I miss was how Civ 4 used to have technologies in the technology tree that had different optional prerequisites. Like you could research one technology or another technology to unlock this technology instead of having to research both. And I'd like to see that sort of thing come back too, that because that allowed you to feel like you could custom tailor the technologies that you research a little bit more towards your specific needs, because you didn't have to research all the technologies on a path to getting the particular technology you wanted. You could focus on the ones that are just the most useful to you, and then, you know, maybe if you want, go and backfill the others later.
I've been slightly distracted by this argument about the nature of the Holy Roman Empire in this thread. I don't know what the heck happened, but...
Start talking about little things and discuss the Holy Roman Empire. Well, that's going to be a bunch of people gone for a while.
Are we bringing things in from EU4? What?
And then something that, so also piggybacking off the privateer idea, something that I don't think has ever been in Civ, but has been in some of the older games that I've played and is in Humankind to a limited extent, is I would like to see the ability to have battles without having to be in an open state of war. I would like if instead of having to declare war, you start out in just like a neutral default state, and then you actually have to sign a non-aggression treaty in order to not be able to attack the other players.
But this is not something that's being added and being returned. This is a new topic.
Yeah, well, right, and that's what I'm saying. Like, this is something that I've seen in other games that I would like, that's similar to the Privateers thing, where there's a little bit more conflict from the other players, and then, you know, maybe you could even have, like, land-based Privateer units, like a bandit unit or something that is functionally similar to a Privateer, but is a land military unit.
Is there anybody that sees an AI settler that doesn't declare on it instantly?
That's exactly the case I was thinking of.
Yeah, like,
I want that neutral.
I don't think it needs to be in the game as a specific thing, because it's already in the game as it is.
Well, a bandit unit is something of a different role, though. That means you can like fight without.
Well, I want some bandit horsemen that can go pillage, even if I don't get a gold return or a faith return or whatever from that. Let me pay some guys that I can control to go let loose on these guys and slow them down. Without formally declaring war.
We have that in the Barbarian Clans mode.
Well, yes, but you can't direct them. I was trying to say, we're talking about the bandit units. Probably phrased that wrong. If I build, I want to be able to build some bandit units so I can send them to do that and let me control what gets pillaged.
Land privateers, basically.
Yes, I want some land privateers.
Yeah, or along the same lines, like hire those barbarian units, those barbarian clan units as mercenaries, but then have control over them, but they still have the barbarian flag, and you can use them to potentially attack or harass or, you know, pillage other players. And then, you know, maybe you don't get anything from it, or maybe you just get a fraction, right? Because you got to pay the mercenaries, you know, too. So it's still less than what you would get if you were in a state of war and sent your own units there. So, you know, in that sense, it's suboptimal. But, you know, it's just another thing to prevent the game from becoming, you know, too passive. So, you know, there are more threats that you have to worry about than just an open state of war, especially out in neutral territory, right? Which should kind of be like a no man's land where like kind of anything goes.
I like it. More blood. It's good.
And then, as you progress in the game, you can have diplomatic repercussions for those sorts of things too. As you get further and further into the eras, other civs should, of course, and even your own population maybe should maybe look down on you if you're doing those sorts of things. You get like some equivalent of war wariness or other diplomatic penalties. Like you can have stuff like that also to keep those things in check, so it doesn't become overwhelming in the late game where just everybody has an entire, you know, army of nothing but bandits and privateers and everyone's just fighting everyone all the time.
Well, these units are usually somewhat worse. Legitimate military units in most times.
In Civ 4, as soon as frigates, like the privateers were really good, but as soon as frigates start showing up, like
you're toast.
Yeah, your privateers are just dead at that. Unless it's like really, really well promoted, you know, then maybe it can fight against a frigate, but like frigates just would go out and stomp all the privateers as soon as they show up.
Yeah, also you should only have diplomatic penalties if you get caught. I think penalties with your Civ would depend on like your governance ideology.
Yeah, sure. But
realistically, it's just not a viable long-term thing. It's something you want to do to like for benefits here or there.
Yeah. And I know that's a little bit off topic, but I felt like it was tangentially related to the privateer thing, so I wanted to throw it out there.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like, you know, it's an expansion of the old privateer mechanic. Sure.
Yeah.
Basically.
And obviously, if you're going to do something like this, then the AIs need to be a lot smarter about protecting civilian units. If a bandit, you know, can just pop out of the fog of war and kill a settler or a...
I would argue the AI needs to be smarter about that regardless of the return of this mechanic.
True, but there's...
what we observe.
But if you had a mechanic like that where other players can hire mercenaries or build bandit units, then there's an even greater impetus to make sure that that's not abusable.
Yes, that's true.
You can only hold so many at one time or something.
Yeah.
Anything else in this thread that anyone thinks is a really good idea?
Scroll around a bit.
No, I'm just sitting here contemplating land privateers right now. That would be great. There's so many times where it's like, if in the game, if I could slow down my neighbor or something, that would be awesome.
They all want to do a little bit of trolling.
Yeah. But it'd probably be limited to earlier eras, like Mega Bearstrand was saying, because if you think about the real life versions of that, because, you know, if it gets found out a government hired off some mercenaries to interfere in another government, oh, that's just absolute diplomatic poop storm.
Yeah,
I mean, we
do still in this world have state-sanctioned piracy and state-sanctioned terrorism. You know, it's all on the down low. The states don't admit to it, but you know, it happens.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much been a thing for human history. At least once you had states.
Yeah, although in the context of
that, really.
In the context of a Civ game, those sorts of actions almost feel like they're more appropriate as like a spy espionage kind of thing than for like an outright military unit that's on the board.
Yeah.
In later eras, definitely more espionage. But in the early eras, yeah, it was as simple as going over and hiring some barbarian or non-stated people and saying, hey, can you go check those guys there?
And hey, maybe that's the transition that happens in game. Maybe your bandit units upgrade into spies.
Now, that's something I would like to see somewhat of a
return. Oh, the spies on the board?
Yeah, tethering spies back into your normal production economy rather than having them like in a parallel system.
Yeah.
Because like everyone gets spies. You, there's some interaction, but...
Yeah, it was one of the things that frustrated me about the espionage mechanics in Civ 5 was that you didn't have to invest anything in espionage. You just automatically got spies and could use them to do whatever. Civ 6 is a little bit better in that regard, but Now, I'm not necessarily saying that I want to go back to Civ 4 with all the extra tedium of having to physically move a spy unit across the board and then, like, never being able to do anything useful for them because you spend all your time moving it across the map and then you use it once and it fails a mission and goes back to your capital and now you got to move it all the way back.
They also had hidden stuff that wasn't obvious to players, like having multiple spies in the same tile increased your chances of getting caught.
Oh, crap.
It would be nice if the game, like, explained that somewhere.
I don't think that ever occurred to me to build a spy stack.
You can. And, like, because, like, if you're using them to, like, lower city defenses by inciting a revolt, because it temporarily removes all defenses on the city, so you don't have to bombard it down, you would want some redundancy there, but you have an increased chance of getting it caught, and it quickly becomes cost prohibitive as a consequence.
I mean, I'm doing...
The game just never explains that.
I'm doing a Captain Picard double facepalm over here because I can't believe that never occurred to me to try. I mean, you could stack workers and that increased the speed with which they completed improvements. So, like, it seems like it should be obvious that you could do the same with the spy. How did I never think of that?
And yeah, espionage is at its strongest in Civ 4 by a wide margin. Like, the fastest culture wins used espionage, spread culture in a hostile city to flip it, which was interesting. While the default espionage cost for stealing tech was higher than the default tech cost to research it normally, if you did everything right, like you had like the founding holy site of a religion in that you're running it and then the target city had that religion and you had culture pressure in the city and it wasn't too far from your capital and you had a lot of espionage investment on the target, you could get techs to like a comically small fraction of the cost stealing versus researching yourself. And make up a lot of ground very quickly. You could engineer that. So there's a lot of like extra nuance to the espionage that just hasn't existed since then because it's mostly free or only like small investment with diminishing returns on like what you could do with your spies. And then like you also had more control over like the likelihood of it getting caught because your opponents could build things that would make it more likely. Like they were spending their production resources on catching spies. And like you could just then produce more spies and put them in different places, or you could sabotage stuff and or like make it harder for them to build that everywhere. Yeah, now, there's a lot more going on there.
Now I'm curious now. You've got me into this rabbit hole. So if you had a stack of spies, do they all do the same mission at the same time? And if so,
one, you could only give an order to one at a time.
But having multiple ones on the tile like increased the likelihood of its success?
No, it increased the chances that you got caught.
Oh.
Which is annoying. However, like you still like sometimes you wanted to do it to make sure that at least one of them would succeed in the mission. So there is like there's a balancing there of like how much you want to invest to make sure this happens versus you're more likely to lose your production. Then.
But if the spy gets caught on that mission, it's only the one spy that gets caught. It's not the whole stack, right?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
So like. It's like basically diminishing marginal utility. Like you put in more hammers and your chance of at least one spy doing it successfully goes up, but you're also more likely to get caught. And you only have a chance of getting caught every turn, even if you take no action. And spies got up to a 50% cost modifier on their action. They were stationary for 5 turns. So like it was prohibitively expensive to put like 10, 20 spies into a city and like stand them there for 5 turns and then do the action. But it could also be prohibitively expensive in espionage points to just do actions without buildup. So there's a lot to consider there.
Yeah, and I remember
that was also just dependent on how likely your opponent was to catch you.
Yeah, I remember the espionage point economy being very difficult and frustrating in Civ 4 because so much of it would get wasted on failed actions, and that was so frustrating.
Well, if you fail the mission or get caught, you don't lose the points.
Oh, okay.
What are we talking about?
But like, there's a lot of like turn build up to accomplish that.
I stepped away for a second. I gotta come back, and now we're talking about spies.
Yeah, and in the various game, I mean, it's loosely related to the topic in that.
Oh right. We're still on the last topic. Okay.
Espionage certainly could see some overhauls and some return of previous consideration, better system Civ 7.
Yep,
but I don't know if I want to like completely copy Civ 4's espionage and paste it into a new game. But there are a lot of things that you had to consider with Civ 4 espionage that just haven't been a factor since then. And some of them were cool.
Well, I definitely don't want to copy having to, again, the tedium of having to move those spies across the map every time I wanted them to do something.
You could move Q the city into the target city. So when you produce a spy, it automatically goes there.
No, that's true. And that goes back to what you keep harping on, which is those little UI conveniences that just make things so much easier and efficient.
Now, unfortunately, Civ 4 didn't, although certainly a better UI could, make it so that once the spy does the mission, you could have like a toggle for it just moves back to that city again.
Yeah.
Or you could change it so it doesn't leave the city. That's also an option. Either or. That would be really powerful then.
Or you could append something similar to what Civ 6 does, which you get a dialogue box asking you if you want the spy to leave the city, and if so, how. And if you want him to stay, but there's a higher risk of him being caught and killed, then, you know, that's at least a decision.
Yeah. You can do it that way too. Yeah, you couldn't fully get rid of the tedium, but you could get rid of most of it. And that's true with stacks too. That's why like stack movement in Civ 4 is better than the one unit per tile. Some of that's just due to the design of stacks versus one unit per tile. But a big part of that's just because Civ 4 had a better UI. So you could move stuff more efficiently at baseline. And, you know, even if we don't go back to Doom stacks, maybe we should make our unit movement more efficient. I'm just saying. Maybe that could make a return in Civ 7.
Well, and as I pointed out before, you know, the other games in this, you know, in this particular space have done things to try to do that sort of thing. Like, I think we all played that Millennia demo, right? And you stack up armies in there, and then Humankind, you actually do create army stacks, but then when you fight battles, you deploy them onto the field and do one unit per tile tactical battles. So, you know, there's ways to do that. And ways to reduce that tedium in Civ as well. And, you know, hopefully Firaxis learned some lessons from those other games.
You just made me, speaking of doing a little trolling, you made me think of like a Civ plus Total War merger.
Well, that is kind of how Humankind works.
I don't have the sheer micro real-time combat that Total War brings.
True, but I mean, it's basically you have your stacks and they meet in the field, which is similar to moving, you know, your large armies in Total War across the campaign map, and then they meet each other, and then there's a screen where you deploy them, similar to Total War. Each player has a zone that you deploy your units in, and then when you're done deploying, you click start battle, and then you play, you know, one unit per tile turn-based battle. And I think in Humankind, you get 3 rounds of battle inside of a game turn. And if the battle is unresolved, that battle carries over into the next game turn. And then you can play 3 more rounds again and potentially bring in reinforcements as well from nearby armies or units. If I think you have to unlock a tech to enable like a logistical tech in order to enable bringing in reinforcements into a battle once it started. So the battles also resolved like quicker in like game time, right? Like it's not like Civ 6 where you can have a siege of a city that goes on for like 100 years in Humankind. Like all these battles would be resolved in like 1 to maybe 3 game rounds, even though that could be 3 to 9 turns of tactical combat.
Yeah, you're talking reasonable. Because I was talking about salt-inducing stuff, like forcing people who are turn-based only to suddenly handle really heavy real-time aspects. I wasn't making a serious suggestion that the Total War. That's not everyone's cup of tea. And man, like that would be such a deviation.
Well, I think at least one of the, isn't was it Aura is like real-time, or is that still turn-based?
We don't know.
Yeah, from what I've seen of Aura, I get real-time vibes from it. But, I mean, it could be turn-based. I don't know.
We've gone 20 minutes over time.
And, yeah, I would not want to put the design of UI for real-time into Firaxis, given what we've seen from 5 and 6. Maybe it could be done. But, yeah, like, just having played a real-time strategy game recently that has questionable controls, like, that is somewhat off-putting that you, like, can't do basic things. In my opinion. And so you have to like, it slows you down. Feels bad.
I think it's time for everybody to get out of the pool. What do you think?
I was just about to say, I think Canis wants to kick us all out of the pool.
Well, it's been 22 minutes out. Oh, it's been an hour and 23 minutes, so it's like, it's a lot of editing.
The ever long episode.
This has been Polycast 434. I'm Canis Albinus, who developed a migraine during the middle of this show. Not because of the people talking, though. We've also got Makalua.
Now I've got to go plot how to use my land privateers.
Me and team.
Bringing more and more APM to civilization.
And Mega Bears fan.
I am a lifelong migraine sufferer, so I sympathize. I have read some research that suggests that green light might help relieve migraine symptoms. So if you have any way to produce green light, maybe try that and see if it helps.
I'll see what I can do. And now I'm going to bed.
Okay, hope you feel better.
Yeah.
Yes.
You didn't wait till the stream ended.
We didn't have to.
Okay, the stream is now dead.
It's okay if the internet hears us tell you to have a good sleep and get rid of your migraine.
Well, it's going to be in the recording at least.
Yeah.
Candace edits it out.
Civilization 4, 3, 6, 5, Beyond Earth sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright the Polycast at thepolycast.net.